Hello, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm still Alan Shartok. The New York State Senate GOP unanimously voted Long Island Senator off the island. John Flanagan is now in the top spot after Dean Skelos resigned as Senate Majority Leader. Skelos was under fire after his arrest last week and subsequent six-count corruption charge, along with his son Adam. This comes mere months after the similar shuffle in the state assembly when Bronx Democrat, boss, Carl Hastie, took the reins following the resignation of longtime Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver following his arrest on federal corruption charges. And today, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced he'd be taking time off to be with his girlfriend, Sandra Lee, as she undergoes treatment for breast cancer. So where does that leave state government, New York State Public Interest Research Group, Legislative Director Blair Horner? We love Blair Horner. If we all have favorites in life, he's mine. Director Blair Horner is in the studio with us, and we're going to talk about it. Blair Horner, welcome back to the Vox Pop.
Thanks for having me, Alan. It's been a spectacularly unusual legislative session. I mean, you're the historian, right? I mean, been around a while.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
When was the last time a Senate Majority Leader and Assembly Speaker resigned in the same session?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Two of the three men in the room.
Two of the three amigos.
Yeah.
And one amigo left.
Well, who called them amigos?
The governor did. And he had a State of the State. In the State of the State address, he had a PowerPoint presentation that went, and he usually puts a few jokes in there. And one was a slide of
bad jokes, I may say.
Well, they are really lousy. They're certainly not top. They're not ready for the comedy club. But they, so they get a few yucks at the audience. One of them was a picture of the three amigos.
Sort of looking like the Cisco Kid.
That's exactly right. And they had the hats and everything, and that was the slide. And so now two of the three amigos are no more in terms of at least being in the leadership of the legislature.
So you're a crusading guy, Blair Horner, and you've talked to all of these people. You know all these people. I have a basic question, and it's one that everybody in Massachusetts can relate to as their speakers get carted off to the Who's Gow, or in Connecticut as their governor gets carted off to the Who's Gow. It's just generally a question about corruption. They know what the odds are that they're going to get caught. Why do they do it?
Well, they think the odds are one in a gazillion.
Yeah,
right? I mean, that's what it is. They've been getting away with it for so long, they figured, what the heck, I can still get away with it. But you're right, it really is sort of a staggering track record. Five Senate majority leaders in a row have had legal problems.
One little two, majority leader, two little,
two out of the four speakers of the assembly.
Yeah.
The last two governors and the previous comptroller went to prison. So it's real. I don't know what the tipping point is, but I'm hoping it's relatively soon in terms of where the Albany crowd decide that it's in their political self-interest to try to fix the place. So far, it hasn't happened.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We want to hear from you. Was Lord Acton correct? Does power corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely? What happens to these guys? They get here. There used to be something, Blair, called the Bear Mountain Compact. You were on the train. A lot of them took the train. And the deal was that after you went past Bear Mountain, everything that happened in Vegas, no, I mean Albany, stayed in Albany.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. I mean, the cultural acceptance of ethical misconduct and sexual peccadillos has definitely changed over
one of my
the last
favorite words,
years.
Peccadillos, goes right with sexual.
I started in Albany lobbying for NYPERG in 1984. And so you can see in that 30-plus year period of time, there's been dramatic changes in terms of what's acceptable and what's not. And I think the use of their outside jobs to basically become wealthy, using their public jobs for private gain, has increasingly become a problem. And that's why you see fewer and fewer of them doing it.
Well, let me ask you a question. Let's just talking between ourselves, the other people
and
out there,
everybody on the
well, they'll tune out.
Right?
So my question to you is this. If on Food Friday, Vox Pop has a show on chocolate chip cookies, every phone is ringing. Yesterday, if we had a wonderful guest, a doctor, and she was talking about, what doctors of osteopathy, every phone was busy. Today, we're talking about state government. I have the best guy in the world on sitting across from me, and there isn't one phone ringing. I ask you, is that because people have given up on not written down the 1-800-348-2551 number, or is it because, frankly, whatever her name was, I don't give a damn?
I think it's a lot of that. I think it's a lot of that. I think that people expect politicians to be crooks, and so when their fears are founded, the public just sort of shrugs its shoulders and says, that's the way it is. And unlike chocolate chip cookies, which are very appetizing and great, and now that you've mentioned them, I'd like to have some.
Have you ever made any? Maybe we can get the phones ringing that way. Yeah, go ahead.
I think people are sort of cynical about politicians and government generally, and as a result are numb, really, to these revelations. I don't think they like it. I think if you poll the questions, do you think government's too corrupt? Do you think it's a big problem? They'll say yes. But it doesn't necessarily translate into legislative action.
But let me ask you this. John R. Arbuckle, I believe, was the great social philosopher appearing in television commercials who said, you get what you pay for. Do we get what we pay for?
No, we don't get what we pay for. That's the problem. And I think that's I think that's what the disconnect is when it comes to the public. They don't connect the fact lousy services, increasing cost of college, lousy health care,
or in the case of, let's say, Dean
Skelly, the fact that the system is bending over backwards to the powerful elites.
So now we have Dean Skelos. He steps aside, but he's allowed to name his replacement. This is unbelievable to me. He's allowed to name his replacement, a guy named Flanagan, and apparently there were subterranean politics going on between, quote, upstate and suburbia.
In the assembly, there's so many Democrats that pushing Silver off the cliff was relatively easy. In the case of the Senate, they have exactly enough Republicans to control the House. And so, in a sense, you needed former Senate Majority Leader Skelos to go along with the deal in order to have the votes to make the change. And so that gave him, I guess, a veto. Part of this, of course, is, like in any leadership thing, there's geographic differences, there's ideological differences, there's how people like each other. I mean, there's all these things that come into play. It was reported, again, that Skelos, Skelos voted for him, but reported that he was supportive of Flanagan.
Right.
And that's what happened.
It was also reported, but we don't know if this was rumor or not, that he said that she said that he had halitosis. No, that was something else. No, that he said that if his conference didn't keep him there, he was going to resign altogether, and then they were out of power because they didn't have enough votes.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it was reported that I think his supporters said that, or at least alleged that he did. That didn't even make any sense to me because he's, just so your listeners all know, like all Americans, he's presumed innocent until proven
absolutely
otherwise. And he states over and over that he is innocent. But if at the end of the day he has to make a deal, leaving office would be one way to help make that deal happen. I mean, the former Assemblyman Bill Scarborough, who was just convicted of malfeasance, basically.
Right.
Part of the deal was he gave up his seat. So why would you give up your seat in advance? It never really made any sense to me that Skelos would threaten that. But as it played out, the person that he would like to see, reportedly, is now the new Senate Majority Leader.
We are going to take a short break. We will be right back. The phones are now loading up. There's one free phone.
You said chocolate chip cookies.
Chocolate chip cookies. Everybody's got a recipe. Okay, go.
Support comes from Empire State Youth Orchestra's ESYO 360 Festival Celebration Luncheon, Small Group Performances, the 360 Concert with ESYO Musicians and Alumni this Sunday, luncheon at 12 noon, concert at 3 p.m., esyo.org for more information. Kent Hicks Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero, passive house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations. Serving Western Massachusetts, KentHicksConstruction.com. The Center for Extended Care on University Drive in Amherst, a family-owned and operated nursing center offering rehab, long-term care, and Alzheimer's specialty care, CECAA.com. Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Curtis Lumber, celebrating 125 years, supporting our communities with sales, service, and supplies at 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com. And College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
And we are back with the incredible Blair Horner, one of my favorite people in the world, and certainly by everybody's standards, the best of the best in Albany. Let's go to Nick in Westfield, Massachusetts. I love the fact that Massachusetts is calling. Just because we happen to have the most people being indicted these days doesn't mean it's not going on in Massachusetts. Okay, here we go. Nick, you're on. You're on.
Nick. Good afternoon.
And so, same to
I
you.
Agree. Thank you. I agree with your point that there is a lot of voter apathy, but I would say that it's also the way the system is designed. You know, there was an article, I think it was in the New Yorker today, about how the system is designed to prevent ethical people from being successful in it. And even people who are activated to try to make reforms are unable to be effective within the current system. So I would ask both of you what your suggestions would be for how to reform the system. I mean, does it need to be a constitutional reform or something legislative at a state level?
Well, Nick, that's obviously a very big question, right? soup to nuts reform is the kind of thing that I work on. But just to sort of focus it down, I mean, in a sense, lawmakers are in a sort of a transactional environment where they're trying to raise campaign contributions, keep their constituents happy, negotiate with ideological foes to come up with compromises. And by its nature, it becomes sort of a transactional place. And that rewards, and I think this is what you were pointing to, it rewards those who are most deft at transactional politics. And sometimes those people get into trouble.
Well, you know, Blair and Nick, I have a sense that what Nick says is really perfectly on target. That's why when my students come to the Legislative Gazette and they learn the language of the legislature, which I think is as obscure as you could possibly find, and they have to figure out what first reading, second reading, third reading, you know, is, and lay it aside means. And so that what happens is, I remember, I think I was the first to try to convince Stanley Steingut that we should pay for TV, for put the legislature on TV. And I remember he astoundingly said to me, "But Alan, who would pay for it?" You know, so we pay for it now, but the language and the circus is so obscure that most people can't relate to it. And I think Nick's right. It was designed that way. It was designed to be that way.
It's designed by lawyers. And so you have sort of a convoluted, often convoluted sort of process. But I think in terms of the individuals—
These are not Harvard lawyers. Yeah, but go ahead.
I mean, the individuals that are there, in order to get ahead— And to succeed, you have to deal with all of these other characters that are there. And it encourages and rewards those who are best at transactional politics. And sometimes the people that are best are the people that end up getting into trouble. Because
what transactional mean again, Blair?
Well, they're basically willing to trade to get things done. Either things that they want for something else that somebody else wants. They're willing to accept certain campaign contributions from certain groups and therefore look out for the interests of the people who make those donations. I mean, and it's a slippery slope.
But they still have I think the other problem, Nick, is that it's an oligarchy. Meaning, in
right.
the end, one guy, you know, you have this thing with 161 people or something like 211 people. How many?
213.
213 sitting in the legislature. And theoretically, they all get together and they make the laws. Baloney. what happens is one guy in one place and another guy in the other place says, listen, boys, this is the way it's going to be. Now, they always argue, no, no, we sit around the conference and we yell at each other, and that's what comes out. But when those
exactly.
two... But when those... Go ahead.
Well, I would say that I agree, and I don't think that transactional politics needs to be unethical, but that like if they did actually represent their entire constituency and they had to engage in transactional politics with their entire constituency, then it would be ethical. But because they're only actually engaging in transactional politics with a small percentage of the population, that's where you have the unethical behavior.
And I agree with that. I think what's missing in Albany are the rules for how to behave when you're in this situation, and then the enforcers to make those rules work.
Hey, Nick.
All of the big hits have been coming from the feds, not the state watchdogs. And it's the absence of the oversight, I think, that encourages this sort of situation.
For a good reason. Nick, thank you for the great call. Appreciate it. There are a lot of people behind you. There's one free phone. After you're off, there'll be two. Thanks a lot, Nick. Okay, let's go to Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Thanks, Alan. That litany that Blair delivered of the top officials' legal difficulties was truly impressive. But it seems to me that the kind of self-serving behavior that we condemn in public officials is honored in the private sector in this increasingly plutocratic society and culture that we have, that people like Litwin and the Kochs and the Waltons and all of them are driving the corruption, whether it's illegal or legal bribery. Mm. And you know, the CEOs have increased their share of the pie by a factor of 10 relative to average workers since Reagan came in. So it's vital for people like the two of you and other journalists and advocates to put the spotlight on corrupt public officials. But we've also got to look at the plutocracy and you know, start electing leaders who stand up to it.
Well, Mark, you're certainly not wrong about one thing I can say, and that is how much did the governor have in his campaign fund when he ran the last time? Do you remember?
It was pushing
$50 million, Mark. And you're really on the target. Who gives you $50 million? Right. So it turns out that the same guys are giving money to all the campaigns. They're buying them all. So that the reason that the Moreland Act Commission, by the way, collapsed was apparently there was a subpoenas that were being issued to the real estate industry. And lo and behold, we're now reading exactly how much money that real estate industry and a specific real estate realtor gave to all of these campaigns.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get what you pay for.
Yeah, Mark fingered the most notable guy, Leonard Litwin, the 100-year-old real estate developer in Manhattan, who was the single biggest contributor to Governor Cuomo, gave upwards of $1 million through various loopholes in the campaign finance law directly to the governor. And, you know, he may believe in the governor. I mean, who knows, right? But generally, the captains of industry don't make charitable donations out of the goodness of their heart. They want something in return.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, it follows what Nick had talked about before. The sort of the underlying problems are these terrible Supreme Court decisions, which have loosened what little regulation existed. And now the sort of the freewheeling campaign finance system leads candidates for office to go for the biggest donors. In New York, it's like the last time we looked, 35,000 New Yorkers made a reported campaign contribution in a state of 20 million people. And who are those people? They tend to be the wealthiest. The average donation to the governor was in the thousands of dollars. Who among your listeners can make those kind of donations? And by the way, if you can, make sure you give it to WAMC. And the lockbox is coming up very soon. That's right. But, I mean, so that's what it is. I mean, you think about it. It's inefficient. The system rewards the candidate who can get the wealthy people or the wealthy interest groups to give them the money. And that means increasingly catering to a very tiny percentage of wealthy individuals, and the rest of us be damned.
So in New York City, I'm so sorry, Blair, you have a campaign finance law where you get $6 back for every dollar you raise.
That's right.
Has that made a difference in which candidates win and run?
Well, I think it has. I mean, it has some effect because people right now, unless you have friends or allies who are wealthy, either institutionally or individually, you can't really manage to run for office. In New York City, because you have a system that rewards a large number of small donors, the state system rewards people who can get a small number of large donors, you end up with different candidates being able to run. Doesn't mean they always win. And it also means that candidates have a different relationship to the public at large. If you're running for statewide office, you got to raise $50 million. You're going to focus your phone calls on the guys who can make $100,000 donations. You're not going to focus your phone calls on the people who make the $100 donations. In the New York City system, the opposite is true. You want to talk to the $100 people because you get $600 back for that. And so the economic incentive as a candidate changes. So your relationship to the voters change. Different kind of candidates can run.
Mark, great question. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Bill in Gloversville, where nobody goes barehanded. Go ahead, Bill.
Professor Emeritus Alan Chartok.
Uh-oh, I got my hand on the dump button, so go ahead.
I would like to go back to a statement made earlier that got everyone calling, which was that people are apathetic, and to extend that or extrapolate from that, they're ignorant, uneducated, not intelligent, and so on and so forth. When in reality, they're up to their neck in crocodiles and snakes. They're working 3 to 4 jobs a week at minimum wage. They're burned out. You can see it on the faces of people who work in Walmart. They go home to a family of 3 or 4 kids who are smoking pot and dabbling in all kinds of drugs. They just want to escape reality. So even if you plastered the television with news about...
Okay, Bill, I think we got some of the point here. Let's go to Blair and see what he has to say about this.
Well, I mean, you know, the basic point that the public is sort of tuning out of what's going on in their own government and not voting. I mean, it bears out in the statistics. In the last election, 2014, had the lowest voter turnout in modern history in New York State.
But
and we
have
one of the lowest voter turnouts of any state in the country.
Whoa, Bill, you had your turn. Now Blair's talking. Go ahead, Blair.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, and so what are the reasons for that? There's reasons. There are institutional reasons. There are obstacles to registering to vote. There's obstacles to voting. So there's those kind of problems. And then there's sort of the general malaise of the public at large, some of which Bill was referring to when he talked about the fact that people are having a hard time making ends meet.
But some of which, it seems to me, have to be seen as people who could better their lot if they got a little bit more intelligent about their politics.
Yeah, but I think that they don't think it makes any difference. And
well,
that's
we know that.
Really the
yeah.
cynicism that sort of undermines the... I mean, because you end up with a democracy death spiral. The fewer people get involved,
sure.
the more the candidates rely on special interests to get elected,
sure.
which makes them more responsive to the interests. So it's the democracy death spiral is what people see, and it's unfortunately, we haven't figured out how to get out of it.
Bill, good call. Okay, let's go to Merrill in Argyle, where everyone wears socks. Okay, Merrill, you're on.
I got socks on.
Okay.
All right, guys.
I got it.
My question is, what would it take to, would it have to be a Constitution amendment to raise the limit, salaries and eliminate all outside income like the congressional?
Okay, good question, Blair.
Yeah, you just need a law. You pass a law that we pushed it, in fact, this year.
So it wouldn't need to be a constitutional amendment.
Excuse me?
It would not need to
That's
be
right.
a constitutional
amendment. You just need a law to do it. You don't need a constitutional amendment. They could pass a law saying that as elected officials, they will cap, the way the Congress works is they cap the amount of outside income to no more than 15% of the highest salary in the Congress, when so it turns out to be roughly $27,000. We had pushed a similar proposal in this latest round after the silver controversy. And, you know, we made some headway, but it didn't happen. And largely because the governor didn't push it hard enough.
Well, Merrill, hold on a second. Let me just ask Blair a question that occurs to me here. How does this work in terms of salary? Can we ever really solve the problem? Because as we see with Dean Skelos, the accusation was his son. How about his brother-in-law? How about Larry Schwartz, who used to run the governor's operation over here? His brother just got made a judge. I'm not saying one equals another, but I am asking you whether you can really ever stop
it. I mean, there are general prohibitions in the law about self-dealing now. Could they be revisited and tightened up? Or using your public office for someone else's private benefit? There are laws on the book now. You can't do that. But could they be tighter? Sure. But someone has to enforce it. And that's where this whole system falls apart in New York.
We used to have this guy, David Grandow. Remember him?
That's right.
He got quite crazy about the whole thing, and he really thought...
He only regulated the lobbyists. So yep. And I can tell you, I am still a lobbyist, that everyone quaked in fear of this guy.
Yeah, because he never stopped.
He was straining at the leech.
He couldn't wait. And he's part of the lobbyists were, not you, you're what we call a goo-goo, a good government guy.
Don't talk about it in the past tense.
Yeah, you know, you are. You're
weird.
A goo-goo.
All right, that's bad.
Okay.
But
you have to see everything, Merrill, as a transmission belt. In other words, the lobbyists aren't here, the legislators aren't there, the governor is over there. Everything works sort of in tandem.
But again, the issue of limiting their outside income would not necessarily have to be tied to a salary increase. I mean, New York state lawmakers have the third highest salaries right now in the country. You could just do it straight up. You could just say, to be an elected official, you have to limit the amount of employment income you have outside your job. And ironically, the vast majority of legislators currently do that.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that our new Senate Majority Leader, the first thing he did was to quit his $150,000 outside job, at least $150,000, with his law firm.
That's exactly right.
And when Dean Skelos got into trouble, what he did was get out from under the law firm.
Well, I mean, and what was interesting in the complaint by the U.S. Attorney's Office against Senator Skelos, they said that he'd earned $2.6 million in that law firm and had not done any legal work for the firm. Zero. Mm. And so what was he doing? Well, he's basically a rainmaker. And so how did he make it rain? Well, he's the Senate Majority Leader. When you used to look at the law firm's webpage, they didn't advertise him as anything other than that. And so that's what they were trading on. And that's where you get into these potential conflicts of interest and real conflicts of interest, which Merrill is talking about. You can limit it. You can limit it with the law.
Merrill, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Len in Woodstock. Okay, Len, you're on.
Hey, Alan, how you doing?
So far, so good. Don't ruin it.
I got a question about the what you discussed this morning about the $211 million that was wasted by our politicians, legislators, relative to the program trying to bring big business into New York.
Yep.
Would you... Could anybody comment on whether there was any, shall we say, bribery or corruption involved in raising the amount from the initial $50 million to $211 million? And also, was there any corruption or bribery in the fact that it didn't do anything and nobody noticed it until it was all spent?
Well, I mean, you know, it's always hard to know if somebody did something wrong until we find out that they did it, right? We're not in that position. But
that's true.
The Startup New York program, the audit that came out from the comptroller's office, which, by the way, in and of itself was an act of political bravery to audit the program.
Our comptroller in New York, if you don't know him, Tom DiNapoli, is an extraordinary man.
Yeah, and he did this audit. He didn't have to do it. I mean, they have lots of things to audit. He chose to audit something which is near and dear to the heart of the governor. This is a governor's program, which, as Len points out, went from being proposed as a $50 million program upwards. And what the DiNapoli audit found is that there were no real metrics in whether or not the money that was being spent on the advertising actually was doing anything other than, apparently, making business leaders feel better about New York. And it wasn't translating necessarily into any additional investments, any additional employment. Now, is that corrupt or is that just a waste of money? The audit doesn't say that. The audit just seems to certainly implies, I think, or a reasonable reader would infer, that it was a waste of money.
Hey, Len, we only got a second here, so go ahead, follow up.
Real quick, Wasn't there any discernible metrics after the $50 million were spent? And who okayed the continual increase in money? Why didn't they use it to fix these roads around here that are awful?
No, you're absolutely right. And I again, and in the audit itself, it said that as fewer and fewer people were applying to be part of Startup New York, the state spent more and more advertising. So there doesn't appear to be any relationship, at least according to the DiNapoli audit, between demand and supply of advertising that was going to this firm.
And then, Len, you got to always remember, all of the rules we have learned in journalism, in contemporary journalism, which is follow the money. Because somebody is going to make out like a bandit, and somebody's going to make a campaign contribution. Len, thank you very much for calling.
Sure. Thank you, Alan.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. By the way, I need a couple of calls now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be talking to Bob in Albany next.
Support comes from Siegel Music Colony, Scroon Lake, New York, bringing music to the North Country for 100 years in 2015 with performances and events June 20th through August 16th. SiegelColony.org for schedule. Neptune's Harvest, organic fertilizers from nutrient-rich ingredients, including fish, seaweed, and crab shell from the North Atlantic Ocean. Available in bulk for farms and retail sizes for home gardening. Neptune'sHarvest.com. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more. Where eyewear is an art, Facebook or visionexceleyecare.com. Flurry Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large. Items such as Benjamin Moore paints, hardwood flooring, Anderson windows, Trex decking, tools, lumber, hardware, flurrylumber.com. The Whistling Kettle, featuring Tea of the Month clubs, tea discovery, wellness tea, herbal and caffeine-free tea, and more. TheWhistlingKettle.com for catalog and online ordering. And Washington County Tourism, featuring outdoor spring recreational activities, including Survive the Farm, fly fishing, artistic events, venues, and museums. WashingtonNYCounty.com.
We're back, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go to Bob in Albany, 1-800-348-2551. Bob in Albany, you're on.
Congratulations, Blair, on your 2001 case, Nyberg versus Cohen, in which you forced New York City to give up lead poisoning blood test scores when the agency didn't want to release them in computer form.
That's right.
Robert Freeman at the New York State Bar Association meeting praised you in that case. Blair, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. You're absolutely
he's
right.
He's listening to you.
That was an important court case. Yeah. It was a way to...
Yes.
He's another hero, by the way, Bob.
He is my hero. Bob. Blair is my hero.
Here, mine
anyway,
too, and then Bob Freeman is right up there.
That's right.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Oh, Blair is a lot cuter. He is handsome, so we can put him on TV.
I get it.
Very important.
Okay, Bob, thank you for your call, I guess. Did you have a question?
Yes. I want to say that we get the government we pay for. We're being penny wise and pound foolish. You just told us that there were fewer than 300 legislators. And if you add the governor and all the heads of departments, we gave them all $1 million a year, it would still cost less than one half of 1% of that $140 billion state budget.
Hey, Bob, you're still assuming.
We don't pay them enough money.
Wait, you're still assuming, aren't you, that if you gave them $500,000 each, that they would behave any differently than they're behaving now?
No, just give them what Blair wants, that 6-to-1 match. If you added the cost of that 6-to-1 match and the $1 million a year salary so that people who aren't lawyers can become assemblymen, then for a cost of under 1% of the 100, meaning $1.4 billion a year, you could get an honest government.
Wait, Bob, what makes you think they could get them more honest if they give them half a million dollars?
I got the professor all angry because he disagrees with me. That's fine. You're allowed to disagree with me.
Well, good, because
I mean,
what you said
opinion.
Isn't right. Okay,
this
now,
is what I believe.
Well, that's
all.
Good. We all have different belief systems, but
I believe you're being cheap, that's all.
Yeah, okay. All right. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
Bye.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551.
Well, I mean, you know, just to go back to Bob's point for a second, though, I mean, the argument that if you paid them more and limited their outside income and had a public financing system, that you would end up with a more with an honest government, your argument is basically that there's no guarantee that that's the case.
No, no, no. I happen to agree, as you've heard today, I happen to agree with all of those, that triangle of premises. It's just that I don't think if a guy is making $500,000, and I think we've had legislators who are making that kind of money, didn't stop them from getting themselves into trouble.
Speaker Silver.
Exactly. Doesn't
But I think Bob's point was we pay him $500,000 out of state funds, and that by giving that more people would want to fight for the position, better people would want to fight for the position. That's the theory.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Okay, here we go.
The Lord Shartok.
Let's go to Jeff in Montague. Okay, Jeff, you're on.
Yes. I'd like to.
Hey, Jeff, get close. Get close to the phone. We can hardly hear you.
Thank you. Can you hear me better
Much
now?
Much better.
Good. Thank you. I believe the best type of managers to have are the public servants that are chosen from the private sector. Of course, successful private sector people. What do you think about that?
Blair, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be said for trying to bring in fresh blood with people that are successful in the private sector and bringing them into government. But it's not always the exact same skill set. In some ways, at least I get my limited experience working in government, so all your listeners know I worked for the then Attorney General Andrew Cuomo for a year, heading up a particular project. I was a special advisor. And my experience from dealing with the government there was there's a lot of things that are all true about it. But in many ways, it's the people that might be best at it would be managers of large not-for-profit corporations, because the incentive system is different. You really can't fire anybody at the state government, which maybe you should, but it's very hard to do that. And so you're really trying to manage, in a sense, a large not-for-profit as compared to a for-profit corporation. So I think bringing in people that have management experience and successful management experience outside of government would help the government. But it doesn't necessarily guarantee that they would have the right skill set to manage government, which is by itself a unique beast.
Hmm. You know, there are not-for-profit profiteers who you know, make a lot of money, Blair. You're not talking to one of them, but you know, I know public radio people who are making.
I worked
well
at the American Cancer Society, which is a huge not-for-profit, $1 billion not-for-profit, the largest in the world, and people got paid a lot of money to be managers there.
May I say one thing?
Sure.
Some of the most efficient businesses are the for-profit ones. And if you want efficiency in government, you should try to go in that direction as opposed to a less efficient system.
Yeah, but Jeff, what does efficiency mean in this case? I mean, does efficiency mean that the bottom line is more important or, for example, helping people is more important? Right? In other words... go ahead.
I would have to say the bottom line is important. Yes, you have elected public officials that would hire this manager, and he'd say, no, come on, you're being too much of a hard guy. Be softer. But you do need efficiency. To keep throwing good money after bad is what we have.
Well, you come from New Jersey, right, Jeff?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry.
And what do you think about your governor? I mean, there's this guy. He got into office by talking about efficiency. Efficiency what? Closing down the George Washington Bridge? I mean, what?
Well, that was disgusting.
Jeff, I understand
your
point.
You're talking about a horrible thing, but I think that I don't think he's a bad governor. I think he's a good governor. By the way, I think Governor Cuomo, a Democrat, is a career politician, is a good governor also. But they, as governors, they're professional politicians. They can bring in people from the private sector, not-for-profits, and they can manage the managers. That's what I'm talking about, really.
I think that, again, I didn't mean by the way before to say that the for-profit managers would not be successful in state government. My point was that it's not the exact same skill set because you're not looking to make a profit. You are looking to be efficient. And so there are definitely efficiencies, and you definitely need modern technology, modern skill sets to make things happen. It's just that the workforce is different. the incentives to them are different, and in many ways it's much more like a gigantic not-for-profit than it is a big for-profit corporation.
Jeff, I'm going to have to let you go. Whoa, Jeff, there are so many people behind you. We only have a few minutes left. I'm going to let you go. I thank you so much for calling. Thank you. Let's go to Mike in East Greenbush. Mike, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, go.
I had an observation years ago when Pablo Dino was running for governor.
Yep.
The way the downstate Republican Party treated him, it was almost criminal. And that shows to me that no way will an upstate politician ever have any power or control in this state. Like right now, you're three men in the room. They're all downstate politicians.
Okay.
That's where the money is. That's where the power is.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think it's ever going to change.
Mike, thank you for that. You may be right. I hope you're wrong. Thanks. Let's go to Bill in Sussex. Bill in Sussex, you're on.
Alan, I'm 63, and I'm ashamed to say I've always underestimated state politics. I've always assumed it more of an administrative position. But these guys vote on things like gun control, gay marriage, very controversial things. And if the governor, the position, he gets to help decide redistricting, which
you
affects
bet.
Congress. And here in New Jersey, Senator Menendez is in hot water. If we lose him, Christie can appoint the next U.S. senator. And that's huge.
That's right.
So we got to get involved in local politics.
Okay, Bill, I'm going to leave it at that only because there are so many people. We want to try to round it all out. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And right you are. Let's go to Elizabeth in Montgomery. Okay, Elizabeth, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, but you got to go fast.
I want to know who approves rate hikes for electric rates, because whatever the Public Service Commission, I believe, right?
That's right.
Why don't they work for us? And who are the public on that commission? Because they don't have any local hearings. I mean, we just got zapped in Oxon Valley with a huge electrical rate because we can afford it.
Okay, it's a given. Elizabeth, now comes Blair. Go ahead, Blair.
Well, there's a Public Service Commission. They're appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the state Senate. But they're, by and large, gubernatorial appointees are supposed to be a semi-autonomous entity. And so you have to impact on them directly. They have a public website. Let them have it.
And by the way, Elizabeth, the political scientists have done a lot of work on this. What happens is that the interests like the electric companies and others that are trying to influence things try to capture, and it's in a word, to capture the agency that regulates them. It happens all the time.
Well,
and
it happens with our legislators, too.
Yeah. Hey, listen, Elizabeth, you raise a good question. Thank you for doing that.
And
you're
there
welcome.
Is legislation. There is legislation to create a utility intervener that would allow the public to be represented more adequately before these rate hearings.
Yeah, fat chance. I mean, these guys
hope
like,
springs eternal.
These guys like the system as it is constructed. Hey, listen, we've got a ton of people here who are doing it online at Vox Pop at WAMC.org. Blair brings out the best in Alan. Great show. A good afternoon, says Mark. I think the answer to Alan's earlier question is that politicians, regardless of party affiliation, are members of this economy's 1%. Because of this, most people have very little sympathy when they get themselves into trouble. Combine that with consensus, cynical belief that politicians are corrupt, and the end result is most people don't care. And Jamie says, two quick points. One is Singapore that praises Prime Minister 2 million a year, and the legislature salaries commensurate with that is the least corruptible government in the world. Two, we have to stop having states compete with each other for businesses, perhaps 4 regional development districts nationwide that would distribute job development as it benefits the people, not the exploiter. This would also cut down on corruption. And then also from Julius, it will be interesting to observe the action of the legislature on upcoming issues of interest to New York City landlords and real estate owners.
It'll be big issues this June.
It is. It's huge. And from Marjorie, good afternoon, Alan and Blair. My question is regarding the old three men in a room members. Since both a Democrat and a Republican have been implicated, how about Mr. Cuomo? He surely must have known of these practices. I believe the commission was disabled because they pressured Mr. Cuomo to do so. That surely smells fishy to me. What's your opinion on that? My opinion is, for whatever it's worth, is that this real estate subpoena that went out to to the real estate industry, and the governor gets a lot of money from the real estate industry. So don't say he must have known that the others were getting it. He was getting it too.
Yeah, well, yeah, and in the Skelos, the complaint against the charges against Senator Skelos, they mentioned that one of the cooperating witnesses is a very, very high up real estate industry person, and if he's a cooperating witness. It certainly could have an impact if the U.S. Attorney's Office is looking. I'm sure they're looking at all elected officials in Albany. Whether or not somebody did something wrong, though, is really the question.
We're going to Frank and Colony. Frank, keep it short and concise, and we're going to be right with you. Go ahead.
Okay, three quick words. Short line redistricting algorithm is the solution to gerrymandering.
Well, yeah. But, Frank, the problem is...
Have you heard of it?
Yeah, but the problem is this. You got to want to. In other words, it's a good idea, but you got to want to. The governor ran for governor the first time. Do you know what his number one priority was? He kept saying over and over again, I'm not going to let them draw their own districts. I'm not going to do that. He gets into, I'm not going to sign that bill. He gets into office and he does it. It's not that you don't come up with some technical way of doing it. It's the will to do it.
And it's an amendment to the Constitution, which is a very complicated thing to get done. But Frank is absolutely right that that would make a big difference.
Do you think the public is aware of
Yeah, I mean, I've been yelling. I'm 73. I've been yelling it for the last 55 years.
I only discovered it last year myself on the Internet.
Yeah. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it. Yep.
Okay.
Okay, let's go to Joe in Ballston Spa. Joe, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for talking about this. I know you've got a little bit of time. I'll get right to the heart of it. What do you, Blair and Alan, what do you think the average listener who thinks the system is stinks, it's rotten, it's corrupt, and is fed up and sick and tired of all this corruption of money buying power. What do you think the average person listener can do and should do?
Well, I mean, there's a million things that people can do. One is to express their outrage to their state senator and their assembly member, whoever represents them, and to give it to them with both barrels. That don't expect to get my vote if you don't fix this by next November. I mean, they're your biggest leverage. They can do all they want with their campaign contributions. They can make all the money on the side. They don't get your vote, they're toast. And so this is the opportunity for voters to let them know. Because right now, I can tell you, because I was just down there this morning, they don't believe they're going to pay a political price for this. And they're not willing to do any more reform, any serious reform, unless they feel pressure from people like you.
Hey, Joe, for whatever it's worth, I have to tell you, I used to work in the legislature many, 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 many years ago.
They have tri-cornered hats.
Yeah, they did. And we all had muskets with us. But one of the things that happened is you would see a guy in the hall, a legislator in the hall, and he would say, my people are killing me on this issue. And when you really got down to talkless with them, you would say to them, so how many letters did you get? They say five. So letter means a great deal.
Yes.
I think these are great suggestions, and I just would like to add, perhaps, that people can do better if they do so in an organized fashion. So
yeah.
Not only as individuals make calls and write letters and even visit their offices, but join with citizens' organizations, with community groups of fellow citizens who are also working for democracy.
Yeah, but
the problem,
Joe, and we got to go, the problem is that some of them, and I don't want to name names here, Blair's is not one of them, when the governor says, okay, I'm going to clean things up with a baloney, good thing, they say, oh, yeah, that's good. We're all for that. That shows progress. Well, it doesn't, and you got to be careful of how you pick them. And I got to tell you.
Careful,
I
agree, right.
Joe, I agree with you, but in terms of people doing something now, now's the time to do it. Because in 4 weeks, these guys are done. And if they haven't done anything, they're going to think that they're right, that they could ride this out.
Joe, we're done.
Absolutely.
We got to let you go. Thank you so much, Joe. That'll
Thank
be the last
you.
Call.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Blair, we love you, and we're so glad you're here. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Mabee Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, New York, presenting Madhouse, the hidden history of the insane asylums in 19th century New York. Book talk and signing with author Michael Keane this Saturday at 2 p.m. SchenectadyHistorical.org. And Rosebud Development, collaborating with residential clients to design and build functional outdoor spaces that reflect their lifestyle. said Rosebud again. I always do that. It's Redbud Development, collaborating with residential clients to design and build functional outdoor spaces that reflect their lifestyle. RedbudDevelopment.com. Borden and Perrin Garage Incorporated. Borden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repairs, services, and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BordenandPerrin.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC.org/VoxPop. Our engineer has been the amazing Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Susie Checkeye. She's terrific. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein, Marshall, so is she. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.